You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to tell you that Alistair McLeod is with me once again. We'd all strongly suggest that you all go to Gold Money, go to the Research Insights page at the goldmoney.com website every Thursday to pick up on what Alistair writes. He writes a very in-depth, I think, very good understanding of what is going on underneath the surface that drives prices and markets as they perform. If you're tired of the sort of superficial stuff you hear every day from the mainstream media, that's a great source to go to. It's one I look forward to every Thursday. Today, I'd like to focus on his article of January 20th titled "Understanding the Inflation Problem." So thank you, Alistair, for being with us again.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
It's always so good to have you here with us. And you started out this article by saying, in recent weeks, inflation has become a major concern, a major economic concern. Nearly all the commentary emanating from monetary policymakers, economists, and the media is misguided, believing inflation is rising prices and must be addressed accordingly. Then you start out your discussion with some definitions that I think are key to understanding the actual cause of rising prices throughout the economy. You made the point to some of those definitions. What is money? What is currency? What is credit? Maybe just give a quick definition of those items, because they're not all the same thing.
No, that's right. Money is actually very rarely in circulation. Money is gold. It's nothing else. It's gold. It is also physical silver. And the reason it's money is because it is nobody's counterparty risk. It has been trusted by different civilizations, even civilizations not in contact with each other, not trading with each other for over 5,000 years. And the only time that it really disappears from our sight is when the world is dominated by fiat currencies. Fiat currencies, basically currencies, are either a representative of gold, if they're exchangeable for gold, or they are fiat. And basically, a currency is a counterparty risk with a central bank. Credit is the counterparty risk that you have with a commercial bank. I mean, bear in mind that if you have deposit money held at a commercial bank, that is an obligation that the commercial bank has to supply that currency to you as you draw down on that credit. In other words, it is not money. It is an obligation, and you are a creditor of the bank. So really, that's the difference. So there is only one form of money, and that is metallic gold, metallic silver, and the rest is currency and credit.
So I guess you define gold as pure money then because of what you just said. It's nobody else's liability, and it's true and honest. It's not the... Because banks, and then there's the fractional reserve aspect of banking too, which even with a gold-backed paper system, we still have the fiat or the fractional reserve banking, which also has its problems, right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, the way to look at a bank, a commercial bank, is it is a dealer in credit. It lends money out at a higher rate than it pays its depositors, and not only that, but it can create credit out of thin air. The very act of making a loan through double entry bookkeeping means that that loan is balanced, at least in the commercial bank's books, with a deposit. It has to be through double entry bookkeeping. Now, you know, the customer's account, you know, who's borrowed money or agreed a loan facility with a bank, will not necessarily see that as appear as a deposit. They will see that only the loan side. But in the bank's books, it's quite clear that on the one side, you have a loan, which is an asset on the bank's balance sheet. And on the other side, balancing it is a deposit, and that is owed by the bank. So, you know, this is the magic of double entry bookkeeping, and it is that basis by which credit is created.
Sleight of hand, essentially.
And well, it's been like that since the days of the goldsmiths, and it was formalized in effect in the Bank Charter Act of 1844. Under English law, and that's been adopted by the world as a whole.
I think very few people understand really that when they deposit money in the bank, they're making a loan to the bank. They think it's their money. So but legally it's not their money. It's just like when you buy stocks and you have your shares with your broker. It's not your, they're not your shares, they're your broker's shares. So,
well, exactly. You know, our grandparents may well have queued up outside a bank which they believe to be failing in order to withdraw cash while they can. So, you know, that, if you like, is proof of the situation.
So if inflation isn't rising prices, then what is it?
Well, inflation is not rising prices. What inflation is, and it always has been under the definition before Keynesianism held sway, is an increase in the quantity of money and credit in circulating in the economy. It's as simple as that. And we have seen a massive expansion of currency and credit ever since the Lehman failure, and more particularly since March 2020, when the Fed reduced interest rates to zero, its Fed funds rate to zero, and started QE at the rate of 120 billion a month. And they've done over 2 trillion of expansion of base money, which has effectively reduced the purchasing power of each currency unit.
Yeah. It's so we have this, so of course we've had inflation in terms of rising prices, rising financial markets, and a redistribution of wealth that has been enormous as a result of the money being, that form of inflation, money and credit being pumped into the system, right? Really destabilizing, yes, socially destabilizing.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there are winners and losers in this. And the winners basically are the banks that create the credit. So long as the credit, which in the form of loans to third parties, doesn't go wrong, you've got the central bank that benefits on behalf of government as the issuer of the currency, and of course the people who are robbed are the savers, who find that the interest has been depressed, if you like, by, or suppressed by monetary policy. Not only that, but you find that as the money, the new money is spent into circulation, it drives up prices behind it. Mm-hmm. And the effect is that the people who get the money first get the most benefit. The people who get it last find that prices have already risen. So, and these are typically the people that you would want to support in an economy. You know, the pensioners, the unemployed, you know, the manual laborers, the people who don't have access to this money until it has already circulated and driven up prices. They are the losers in this.
Well, we certainly have rising prices that are beyond the financial markets now. We have them in the real economy. I think I've seen somebody, I think the general consensus is we're going to see a 7%+ CPI print this week when it comes out here in the States, and we have interest rates at, you know, 5% below that on the 10-year. We were talking before we started on the show, and you were suggesting that you believe the central bankers have finally now given up the notion that this is transitory, but you don't think that they've come anywhere near to understanding the magnitude of the price rises that are in front of us. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes, I think broadly that is the case. I would suspect that the central banks are now getting very worried about the situation because they obviously got it wrong. And I think their advice from their economists was wrong about the prospects for inflation. This is something which, should never have happened. I mean, if central banks actually understood more what was driving prices, and it is the debasement of the currency that is doing it. Mm-hmm. Whenever we've seen this in the past, we see it happening on prices first. I mean, go back to, Roman times, when, prices started rising in the wake of the debasement of the coinage. They were adding base metal into silver coins, and the result was that the purchasing power of the silver coins was going down and down and down. So what did the emperors try and do? What they tried to do was to stop prices rising by putting out an edict. And then you get something which is completely left field, like a harvest failure, and then suddenly mm-hmm. you've got everybody starving on top of the debasement.
We lost Alistair.
COVID disruption and the logistics disruption, and I mean, it just so happens that with all the money printing that has been going on, or the expansion of currency and credit, that this has sort of come on top and has sort of made it real in terms of prices. And it's not going to go away. There's an awful lot of currency and credit inflation in the pipeline, which is yet to affect prices. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because the channel in which the expansion of currency has occurred has really been through quantitative easing. So it's gone into institutional hands, mm-hmm. and that has been invested in the market. Now, when existing stock has been bought, then that basically doesn't go into GDP. It just sort of goes around the financial system, driving mm-hmm. up prices. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, it goes into new issues, then it leaks into the economy, as that is spent by the issuer. So, there are differences, but basically, there's an awful lot of currency and credit inflation in the pipeline, which is yet to be reflected in the loss of purchasing power of the dollar. Mm-hmm. And it's not just confined to the dollar. I mean, if you look at other currencies, I mean, there are worse problems in Europe, for example, who've got themselves stuck on negative deposit rates. And the problem there is that negative deposit rates have led to an overblown repo market, which I would guess at the moment is in excess of 10 trillion euros in size. Now, as we go positive in interest rates, mm-hmm. that is going to start diminishing. Now, that amounts to a contraction of bank credit. Mm-hmm. And, so what's the ECB do? It's got to print at an even faster rate through its asset purchase programs and COVID relief programs and all the rest of it. And mm-hmm. as it is, they are basically buying all the debt issued by the Italian government, all the debt issued by the other pigs. This is, I think that there is likely to be a huge great banking crisis. It's on the back of contracting bank credit within the Eurozone. And of course, even though US banks are relatively well capitalized, mm-hmm. this systemic problem, isn't going to be confined to the Eurozone. It's going to affect us all, and it will certainly affect US dollar markets.
Well, we saw Nixon try price controls in the 70s, and then ultimately, of course, that can't fix it, because when you control prices, you get less when you need to get more of something, and so the prices, the pressure builds. And ultimately, Paul Volcker then slammed on the brakes, stopped the money growth, and we had these enormous – it was very painful. I remember it well as a young man, but it fixed things for a while, at least, and we had price stability for a long time afterwards, at least relative to what we had. I think it was DeMartino Booth that mentioned recently, I heard her say, the Fed is in an impossible situation. No matter what they do, they're going to commit a policy error. They can't raise rates because of all the debt that's in the system, and yet they cannot not raise rates because of the inflation, because of price rises. So I would guess, Alistair, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would guess you believe they will have a bias towards erring on the side of easing and inflation, right?
I think that is all but certain, because their mandate is basically to protect the economy rather than protect the dollar. I think it's as simple as that. And while we're talking about the prospects for interest rates, I think the first thing to understand is that interest rates are not the price of money, and this is where the Keynesians get it horribly wrong. They think that by regulating interest rates, they can regulate demand for currency. That is not the case. Interest rates are basically what the market expects to be compensated for in the context of the declining purchasing power of the currency over the period in which a lender is without his currency. So, if the market expects the purchasing power to depreciate by, say, 5 or 6%, then it's going to require at least 5 or 6% return for the deposit to be intact. And that is before we consider counterparty risk and before we consider the fact that they've actually sort of lost the facility to use that money and given that facility to someone else. So, we're in the situation where rates are horribly suppressed. I mean, if you look just at the CPI, we've got the 10-year bond is yielding, as you say, about 1.95. We're sort of moving up towards 7% increase on the CPI. So already we've got strongly negative yields. I mean, this is a situation which can't continue. That's on government figures which are suppressed. I mean, if you look at shadowstats.com, yep. Mm-hmm. They reckon that a more effective number for the CPI is rising 15%. So, this is an untenable situation. And, I remember this, three gilts issued with a 50% coupon. Now, imagine what happens this time with more monetary inflation than we saw in the 1970s. I mean, is this going to stop at 2% Fed funds rate? No, it's not.
Well, it took, 15, 17% on our first mortgage to stop the one in the 70s, which was much less onerous, as you say, at that point in time. So then, an Austrian concept, a crack-up boom. Could you describe what that is, what that means, the definition of a crack-up boom? The Austrians talk about these kinds of situations ending in a crack-up boom.
Yes, indeed. I mean, basically, a crack-up boom is when the general public, lose all faith in the currency. When they lose faith in the currency, they will dump it for goods they don't even need, just to get rid of it. And that is basically the crack-up boom. We get milder versions of this when we see shifts, if you like, in consumer behavior. If consumers think that inflation means that things are going to cost more tomorrow than they do today, then they're going to reduce their liquidity. So you've got, if you like, the sort of shift that you get in the more violent form with a crack-up boom. You see that developing in a sort of milder version. But what it does is it will drive our prices at a faster rate than the increase in the quantity of money would suggest is reasonable. So this is an important thing, which I think we are beginning to see, and I have no doubt that the central banks are terrified that this movement might gather momentum, because then the whole thing gets beyond their control.
Alistair, you mentioned that we're, negative interest rates about 5% here in the U.S. Going on the 10-year, using the 10-year treasury as a measuring stick. And yet, that's normally very bullish for gold and silver and commodities. And I think commodities are doing well, but gold and silver are just sitting still pretty much. How do you account for that? Because we should be seeing a booming price in these monetary metals, I would think.
I think that two things to say, and that is that markets are basically broken. So the idea that the current price of gold and the current price of silver is a realistic market value is very, very questionable. And the second thing I would say is that it is very definitely in the central bank's interest not to see a rise in the price of gold, because that sends a very, very clear signal that the paper currency is going down the toilet. So they will do everything they can through their agents, which are the large banks. What I was saying, if I'm back online, as it were,
yes,
is that central banks do not want to see the price of, for the very simple reason that it sends a signal that their currency is falling in purchasing power, and mm-hmm. that is something they will not want to see. So they have, through their agents, sat on the gold and silver price. I mean, look at silver, for example. This is the number one commodity for the new environmentally, non-oil, non-carbon economy. And yet, it's hardly gone anywhere. If you look at lithium, that's gone up, what, 4 or 5 times in the last year? Look at uranium. That's more than doubled. I mean, so the answer really, really is that silver is just completely mispriced on an industrial basis alone, before you consider the monetary qualities of the metal. I would say that, I think we are on the verge of coming out of a long period of consolidation, and I think there's a lot of catching up to do. And the problem, I think, for anyone contemplating holding gold and silver is they've got to hold it for the right reason. You've got to have physical gold, physical silver, which you will spend when paper currencies fail. Now, if you place a high likelihood on that failure occurring, then have lots of physical gold and physical silver. If you think it's a distant likelihood, at least have some as an insurance policy.
Right. All right. Well, we're just about out of time. I wanted to ask you, we know now that inflation, rising prices at least, are caused by an excessive amount of money and credit in the system. What are the chances that that these guys will, wake up and smell the coffee, so to speak? The policy.
Zero. Zero, Jay. They can't change course because they do not have the mandate to do so. They will continue with their Keynesian beliefs until they are completely disproved. So this is why you have a crisis first, which is overdue, by the way, because, it's like ringing a gong regularly. Banking crisis or, recessions or property crisis, whatever, is every 10 years, give or take a year or two. And it's now, 13 years since we had the Lehman failure. So the next one is overdue and is shaping up to be major. And it's interest rates that will probably tip it, and probably from outside America. And my guess is, likely to be from the Eurozone.
Interesting. Well, we'll be certainly keeping an eye on things and checking in with you from time to time to see what your thoughts are. And I guess we want to be prepared as much as possible for that event when it comes. Thank you so much, Alistair, for being with us once again. And we look forward to talking to you again sometime soon. Well, folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, Frank Holmes will be joining me. He's started a new ETF. This has to do, it's called the Global Sea and Sky Cargo ETF. It's a New York Stock Exchange, SEA is a symbol. And Quentin Henning will be with me once again to talk about Novo Resources to give us an update on that company that's been a long time sponsor of this show. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Firefox Gold is exploring in Finland in the midst of an exciting new gold rush. Firefox successfully drilled high-grade and visible gold in 2021 and is now active at 4 prospective projects with plans to drill continuously through the first half of 2022. The company's strong international leadership team, combined with its Finland-based exploration specialists, are driving the company to discovery, and the stage is set for Firefox to identify multiple new gold deposits. Firefox Gold trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol FFOX.
and on the OTCQB at FFOXF. Go to FirefoxGold.com to subscribe for updates.